Mini episode 787 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 787. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, and we are doing a little bit of a reprise on the show today. Right about a year or so ago, we had on this gentleman to discuss the state of the Chicago Cubs, a very interesting franchise at the time, because 2015 was their big breakthrough year and the sign that the BOF team's rebuilding project was really picking up the necessary steam. And in 2016, subsequently, they took the final two steps, making the World Series and winning the World Series. So with that in mind, we've got Chicago sports media executive Jerry Clark back on the program here to talk us over his thoughts and his observations on a baseball season that nobody in the Windy City will ever forget. Jerry, welcome back to the show. Sir, how are you today?
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back with you. It's been a fast and furious 12 months. A lot's happened since we last talked.
It has indeed. And again, it was a season that ended in some disappointment a year ago. It was a thing where ultimately, you could see that this team was headed for even much bigger things than that disappointing National League Championship Series loss. 2016 was a year that everybody kind of circled. A lot of baseball pundits out there, myself included, installed the Cubs as the preseason favorites. They really kind of seemed almost prohibitive favorites. You saw them getting named by more people in the media than you would generally see at the beginning of a season. If there was ever a year with a consensus, it seemed to be this year with the Cubs. And what's interesting is they pretty much went wire to wire and justified it, even with the loss of Kyle Schwarber right off the bat during the season, something that would be ruinous to a lot of teams. So in terms of the pressure, the expectations to not just take the final two steps as they did in 2015, but really sort of validate the amount of young talent that they had on their roster, essentially, again, this looked like a team that, at least from afar, that really wasn't carrying much pressure during the year, notwithstanding the expectations. So what was the reality of it, Jerry?
Planning like Theo and Jed have done, but it also takes a little good luck, doesn't it? It takes a little good fortune to make sure that these guys have breakout years. With the unfortunate circumstances with Hayward at the plate, you see guys come through and, you know, Fowler comes through, and he fell in our lap because he was almost a Baltimore Oriole. And that deal went south. He landed back to us. And, it just seemed that this was a team of destiny. We got up to an early lead of, 21 games over 500. But people failed to realize that throughout the hot months of summer, we were about a 500 team until around late August. And then we really sparked. And then the Cubs got hot. And they carried it from there. So, you know, we had a few injuries. But that's a good fortune. We maintained that 21 game over 500 for most of the year. And yeah, we really went crazy at the last, month and a half of the season. And that was a total team effort. And in Hayward's defense, okay, some guys, when they have a bad, day at the plate or a bad season, he went out and played a stupendous right field. So, he didn't, he always contributed with his glove and his defense. And, hey, it helps the team win. So there's the good luck. There's the good fortune.
Yes, they were able to get something on at least one side of the ball, so to speak, out of him during the season. And something I'm curious about, we look at the ultimate outcome of the season for the Cubs and the way that it ended, the way that they and all their fans and the organization wanted. But I'm curious if there was already sort of a consensus before this all happened, because I know that over the last couple of years, coinciding with this regime coming in here and maybe even predating it in some ways, the plans for the renovation finally going ahead, taking shape. I know there was a decent amount of controversy for a period of time there about the refashioning of the ballpark and the trade-off in terms of preservation versus new revenue streams. I'm pretty sure at this point in time to say that every Cubs fan out there would say, hey, it's worth it, whatever has to happen to have built this team and keep it together. But during the season, was that already getting to be a consensus of like, hey, whatever it takes to win, this team is winning, they can go all the way, I'm comfortable with this? Essentially, did it wipe out the last vestiges of resistance to the changes even before they won the World Series?
I think people more than ever wanted to win in Chicago, and they saw some previews, really. I want to say they're moments in time, they're snapshots, they're glimpses. And this is, you know, the way the Cubs were playing last year, and even though they lost, you know, to I think that was at San Francisco. I can't remember who they lost to last year in the divisional series. But
the Mets.
This is very reminiscent of the 84 Bears when they were going to playoffs, and they just lost to, I think, a guy named Joe Montana. And then they came back with a roar the next year and completely blew the league apart. Michael Jordan's teams were kind of sparked by how well they did against Boston and Detroit. And then all of a sudden they come back and they get, you know, two three-peats. You can almost see that these teams are going to be the teams to watch and to reckon with. And the Cubs were no different. You saw how strong a finish they had last year. They played very tough in the playoffs, and so they lose. But you know what? They learn a lot, and they knew where they were lacking. So in of itself, that loss last year really gave the Cubs fortifications to know who they need to get, where they need to plug them in, and how they're going to get to, you know, the expectation of winning a World Series. And I thought they did an exemplary job of planning and, you know, infusing these players that came in, and every single one of them contributed exactly how Theo and Jed wanted them to be. And, of course, they got a wonderful manager who knows how to handle young players and get the most out of them. And he never panicked. Joe Maddon never panicked. And I think that's extraordinary in a manager.
In true Joe Maddon fashion, he was able to move the players around an awful lot. They benefited from depth, and clearly that helped them in the absence of Kyle Schwarber. But you had guys, Ben Zobrist is just the sort of the tip of the iceberg as far as guys that would move around in different positions. You got Baez moving around, and all these guys out there. So sort of an interesting sort of tableau that they had going on there. As far as it goes with Maddon vis-a-vis the World Series, how much heat was there locally going into Game 6, Game 7 of the World Series, where, again, the first several games of the World Series, again, he's matching up with another mastermind in Terry Francona, mm-hmm. and by and large, it looked like Francona was getting the better of him strategically, not least of which because he was getting more out of less. Was there a lot of heat on, I can't imagine there's any right now on Joe Maddon, but was there any sort of leading up to the end of the World Series as far as how that had gone with some of his decisions?
Yeah, you know, when the Cubs were when they were getting shut down, I think they were batting like 182, you know, in the playoffs, you know, the team batting average, and everyone seemed to be going for the long ball. And there wasn't a lot of modifications made to play small ball, get on base. You know, the Cubs are a free-swinging team. And in the advent of free-swinging, you know, you can make a lot of outs and you can lose a lot of close games, which was, you know, starting to make itself evident. But, you know, as the Cubs saw these Cleveland pitchers more than once, more than twice. But one thing about Maddon, he knows how to get the most of his players, and they know how to gauge their game the more they see these pitchers. And so I think over the course of time, you know, the Cubs were starting to get the hang of these guys. They weren't getting fooled like they were the first couple of games when they faced, you know, Kershaw. He was no problem that night, was he? They really teed off on him. So give the Cubs credit, you know. You may fool them once, but you won't fool them twice. And absolutely not a third time. So I like the way the Cubs react, you know, to a good pitcher, good defense, and it was a well-played World Series. Any given day, Cleveland could beat any other team in the league, and, you know, if it wasn't for that rain delay, I don't know if the Cubs would have pulled that game out because the momentum was on the Indian side.
It really was. It was fortuitously timed for the Cubs, no question about that. And as far as it goes, yeah, the Cubs did defy a trend in Game 7 because I saw a stat going into that game that indicated Corey Kluber did better the second time around on seeing teams this year and even better the third time around. So maybe it was having that compressed into the World Series that helped it to go the other way. The Cubs had it kind of fresh in their minds of how to match up against them, but they did something that very few teams did against a pitcher who, a Cy Young Award voting aside, is arguably the best starting pitcher in the American League. But in terms of that series, let's drill down into that a little bit more in terms of the Cubs' struggles through the first five games of the series, or the first four, I should say. Was there a little bit of an unnerving kind of a factor for the Cubs when, again, you look at the history going back to 1908 and all the improbabilities here? This would have seemed to be another one right in their path here, something that shouldn't go against them but does. This Indians franchise being sort of a pixie dust collection here, being down a couple of the great starting pitchers that really could have helped match up a little bit better against the Cubs, and having an outfield that was basically comprised of just platoon parts there at the end, and somehow pulling away to take that lead. Was there a sense of here we go again, just based on the unlikelihood of the team that was beating them at the time, or was that not really a factor?
Well, no, there was a lot of doubters out there, and I was one of them. Like, well, you know, they gave it a good try, and it was a little bit reminiscent. I'm like, well, you know what? We were down 3-1, and you're going to Cleveland, and now you have to win 3. And, you know, that really seemed insurmountable, doesn't it? It really does. As Colas, it was playing every facet of their game very well. And so, you know, the pressure, it's very daunting, and you start to second-guess, and you start to criticize, and you know, that's always because, the passion in Chicago to finally capitalize on an opportunity. Didn't come last year, but this year you're in it. So I give them all the credit in the world, these Cubs, because, you know, they had to go there and completely turned around. And I thought they did that in pretty grand style. I thought the Cubs, even though that last game, you know, they were down and the rain delay hits, they come back and it's the Cubs team of old. They came out doing the thing they do great, you know, situational hitting. They made the plays when they had to, and they're pitching. You know, we were down to a couple of pitchers who really probably weren't planned to be in the seventh game in the closing inning. Isn't that kind of how fate goes? That's where you get that little bit of luck, isn't it? Where you get a guy out there.
Absolutely.
You didn't, right. You're counting on Chapman or someone like that coming out, and you end up with the junior, Edwards, or I can't think of his name right now. But that young man has a lot of stuff. They bounced him out, and then here comes Wood. Of all the unlikely heroes, Travis Wood, who really, you just never planned it like that, and he came out, and thank goodness we came out on the higher end of that. But there's a little bit of luck for you, right?
Well, yeah, and some of the same things materializing on the other side. That's what happens when you go to extra innings in Game 7 of the World Series. You see the guys you didn't expect to see necessarily, and Brian Shaw, who all year long has been working kind of a tightrope act, in the end, I think proves that his name is just Anglo for Jose Mesa based on how he conducted himself in the 10th inning there. But it's a really, really interesting set of circumstances with these guys as far as the pitchers that ended up being in there at the end and some of the other players that ended up being in there. Obviously, if Terry Francona had it to do over, Michael Martinez wouldn't be the last guy up at the plate, basically sort of handing the World Series to the Cubs even before that last at-bat was done, because that is one of the least formidable hitters, I have to say, in all of the American League for all that he brings you in other ways. So you really sort of get down to bare bones at the end, and the Indians had been kind of scraping bare bones through much of the World Series, just trying to fashion their way through. I wonder to what extent, if the Cubs were maybe a little bit relieved not to face Ryan Merritt coming out of the American League Championship Series. That was something that sort of got questioned in terms of Game 5, putting Trevor Bauer out there. And, again, he didn't get the old bleeding finger thing going, but he really didn't seem to have his stuff versus you throw the unknown rookie out there, maybe you get Lightning to strike twice like against Toronto. Was there any kind of a sense in the fan base, if not the team, that maybe that was one that Francona maybe should have gone the other way and that they were lucky not to have to face the unknown kid?
I think that Francona has the same, you're up 3-1, you want to shut him down, you want to get this thing concluded as fast as possible. I mean, who would have thought that the Cubs would have come back in the Game 7? And Bauer's arm was maybe a little, you know, tired, you know? I thought that when you looked at Chapman, he was very beatable when he was out there in the mound sweating like he was, and he was a fool and a soul. So it seems like both guys tired out almost simultaneously, and you couldn't count on them. I was expecting Jake Arrieta to come out and close the game out, since he only pitched 4.5 innings the preceding day. He said he was ready. That's the guy I would have put out, but they didn't even call upon him. Nor did they call on John Lackey, who's got a lot of playoff experience. So you know, Madden has he has his ideas. He knows how to he knows what he's doing, and you may second guess him. But you know what? How can you criticize a guy who wins the World Series for the first time in 108 years?
Well, exactly. And in terms of Arrieta coming out there, yeah, it would have been very reminiscent of Randy Johnson back in 2001, that being another series that went seven games, and this being arguably the best World Series since then. Arguably, because we've had some other pretty good ones this millennium, but reminiscent in some ways of the way that 2001 went as far as the back and forth of it all. Something that surprised me, I wonder if it surprised you, it was Game 7. I'd heard some chatter ahead of time about this, and the ratings had been up going into it. This had been the best World Series ratings-wise in a number of years, and that was to be expected, I think, with all the different subplots that came into play here with the history of the Cubs and the Indians. But to beat Game 7 of the NBA Finals, I would have never believed it. The heights that the NBA is riding to right now, again, the NBA is pop culture. Baseball basically is not. Best players in baseball are not really known to the mainstream, certainly the way that the NBA top players are. I mean, on and on and on. When you look at the centrality of the NBA in American life and baseball, unfortunately, in my estimation, sort of receding back into a little bit of a niche pursuit these days. I would have never believed that it would have outpaced Game 7 of the NBA Finals, and it did. How shocked were you about that, if any?
Out here in Chicago, we thought we were going to have the highest ratings just because of the two teams that are clashing. You know, the Indians had been won in, 76 years, and ours was 108, so, you know, something like that. And, you know, that's good theater, and both teams were playing good. They were both hot. They were both well-managed, and you know, they were long-time MLB franchises, you know, storied franchises from yesteryear, not like, you know, newcomers that you see come in and, you know, like when Miami won in 97, a relatively new team. I think this was something that people really wanted. I think that it was, the stage was set. It was great baseball. Hey, if you didn't catch Game 1 or Game 2, you'll end up watching it because I thought the coverage was great. I thought the announcers were great, and if you saw the crowds outside of both stadiums, I mean, that was really exhilarating. And how could you not, as a sports fan, want to watch something like that? To watch one of these teams, you know, win the World Series in how many decades? You have to, no matter who you pulled for, it was really great TV. And I thought that that we would have a pretty close to a record, you know, coverage and audience base. And we're pretty happy about that. I don't know if it's just because of Chicago or if it's because of both, but I just thought we had a real good chance to make history, and it's just too bad that we didn't close it out in Chicago at Old Wrigley Field. That would have been the biggest ticket in sports history had that closed out here, if I'm not. That would have been the biggest ticket in sports history.
It really would have. So I have to ask you the question just as a follow-up here, because I've got a couple things I want to ask about the aftermath of the World Series, but since you started to go there, I'll continue along these lines. You look at the Cubs having the best record in baseball this year. They have to be the leaders in the clubhouse for next year, and it may not be too early to say 2018 as well. Is there a lot of relief locally that as part of the new CBA package that they have stripped out the All-Star game determining who has home field advantage, i.e. the Cubs would have home field any year where they have the best record in baseball and would have had it in 2016 had that been the case? I got to believe locally that's a case for a lot of smiles.
Well, you know what? I think you're right about that. And, you know, you don't get into too much legislation about baseball. There's nothing you and I or any fan can do about it. That's old Mr. Selig who hit the Hall of Fame today. And, you know, I have my grievances against his tenure as commissioner, but that's for another day. But, you know, I think that regardless of the Cubs would have had home field advantage or not, it was our year, thank goodness. And it's irrelevant where we won it. We took the game, we won the series, and we were happy to win it no matter where we were playing. And we were just thankful that finally, the trophy came home, the title came home in Chicago. First time, you know, the last time there was a World Series in Chicago, they didn't even have radio. Yeah, you know, you probably had to watch it by smoke signals if you didn't go with the game. So that's pretty historic stuff. We're very happy about that, regardless of, you know, the All-Star game, you know, which is kind of irrelevant. It's almost like the Pro Bowl in NFL football. It's just it's a show. And I think
right.
That, you know, you're right. It's a subculture to basketball where it used to be the other way around. But I think the steroid era killed it. I do. I think that, you know, turned a lot of people off. And and we make heroes out of guys who maybe didn't do it all naturally. So I guess I have a grievance
right.
against that, too, but there's nothing I can do.
Sure. No, I understand on that. And something that I want to ask about as well, with you having covered Chicago sports for a good long period of time here, the very, very interesting thing, when we talk about all of this, and we talk about the happiness in the city and the joy in the city erupting and whatever, oh, by the way, it's a split city. Now, I understand that one of the two teams is more of a distinct minority than the others, but I haven't heard a whole lot about what the White Sox fans have had to say over this period of time. So is there a lot of jumping on the bandwagon, a lot of commonality just because it's a Chicago team, if not jumping on the bandwagon? Is there bitterness? How are the White Sox fans? Are they just retreating into their shells? I'm fascinated to know, what the response is, or if it's a variety of the above.
Well, it's like that famous, quote, when someone doesn't like what they hear, they answer no comments. And that's pretty what comes out of Sox camp. And, there's no room to criticize. They're just not commenting. It's silent. It's like you're yelling at the rain. They haven't really said much, nor did the Cubs fans say much when the Sox won. So it is divided. It's like North and South here in Chicago. And that's too bad because I like both teams. I like both teams a lot. And too bad that the fans are so divided. But their loyalties are, and, baseball is more traditional than people give it credit for. Generations
right.
of fans. My grandfather was a Sox fan, my father was a Sox fan, and I'm a Sox fan. You're going to find very few people becoming Republicans and going for the other side. They don't do that here in Chicago. And but I
sure.
think it's a win for the whole team. I do. I think there was some closet Sox fans that came out as closet Cub fans just to be part of the celebration. And it really was something. If people haven't seen 4.2 million people in one place, you have to see that once in your life. And I didn't go down to Grant Park. I drove around the crowd. I went downtown for covering, and I couldn't. It was a melee. I've never seen that many people, and you can see them for blocks and blocks away as you're coming down Lakeshore Drive, and everybody's well-behaved. Out of 4-plus million people, 5 people got arrested. So that's really the hallmark. It was a good, controlled celebration. Nobody rioted. There was no murders. And it was just a good feeling all around. And that feeling still is here. People are still talking about it. And, it doesn't matter what the Bears do. The Cubs won. And so we're very happy with that. And I guess that feeling's going to continue on all the way up to opening day, because we have that little bit of a bragging right up until we lose our first two.
Yeah.
The other guys get paid, too. You can't say we got a dynasty. We have a good club. Barring injuries, we could be back there again, as Kansas City was. But it takes a lot of good luck and a lot of, injury. And everyone's going to, hopefully, Hayward next year contributes at the bat. So if they lose Fowler, Hayward's coming through at the bat. And I know he has all the potential in the world. Who knows what happens?
Sure.
There's guys because they'll have bad years. Sometimes you can't put your finger on it why that happens. But you know what? It didn't deter him from contributing with his glove. I give him a lot of credit. He really went out, tried hard every day. I wish he could have hit more, but in spite of that, they still had a juggernaut offense. So, yeah, it was very exciting, and we'll see what happens, in 2017, won't we?
Oh, yeah. And again, I think, on paper, you can't really crown anybody a dynasty until they've done it, but just on paper, looking ahead, they have what it takes, and including to this point in time still, a very, very good farm system that's only going to continue to replenish. And I want to ask a little bit about where we go from here as far as the Cubs in a second, but just to follow up a little bit here on the whole thing as far as the reaction to winning. Again, I thought I was greatly impressed at seeing 1.3 million people turn out for the world champion NBA Cleveland Cavaliers. But again, 4 million people trumps that. I have to admit, the way that everybody came out, and again, you got to think there was at least a few White Sox fans in the crowd to be able mm-hmm. to get it to that number. But I'm really interested to know, because again, you talk about this thing, what it's meant to the city of Chicago, and again, leaving aside the White Sox factor and that the fact that baseball is the one sport where it's a divided fan base, has the Cubs thing, has this really, in your memory, meant more than, say, the 85 Bears, the replenishing of the Blackhawks championships in recent years, the Jordan Bulls getting 6 titles. Has the Cubs one really seemed to mean more locally there as nationally. That seems to be the case from the outside looking in, that everybody is taking more joy from this?
Yeah, it's more magnified. The Cubs are more magnified by about 20 times of what the national, you know, people see, because of the fact that they were horrible teams for many years and sprinkled in a couple of competitive teams. But for the most part, sad facts, weren't they? And the White Sox, they've had a little, you know, luster too, but they went a long time without winning, and that was a good feeling. But the Cubs far surpassed the 2005 White Sox in that win. I think that, you know, everyone loved Michael, but, the Bulls weren't that old when they won their first championship, you know. They weren't 8 years without winning. So seemed to bring in that zest into the city, and everyone rallied around him. He was a very likable, lovable, you know, a person, a personality. Everyone got behind him. So those were great victories. And the Hawks, again, you know, it was nice to see them come back and have a renaissance, and they're a good team still. And they haven't had very many high draft picks. So a good testament to Stan Bowman. And I think that Jed Hoyer is going to do a good job. At the White Sox, you know, here in Chicago, they're kind of far removed. You know, the ballpark doesn't have a lot of extracurricular activities. People get on the train to go home. People don't, you know, stay around the neighborhood there. It seems to be the White Sox have to win the draw. And if they don't win, they're not going to draw. And then Mr. Reinsdorf is a very stubborn man. He will never sign the kind of guys that the Cubs are signing. Cubs have a good – the Cubs are becoming very reminiscent of, say, Bill Belichick's New England team. There's a system in place, and it works. I think Jed
absolutely
and Theo have a system that works. No matter who you plug in, Zobrist played almost every position, and he was a gangbuster. And whoever they put in left field, Coughlin, there was all kinds of guys that just were inserted for a couple of games to give the other guys a rest. And then, you know, we got Schwarber coming out and doesn't miss a beat. And he's not, you know, facing off against the lowly Tampa Bay Devil Rays. He's hitting against the top guys in the American League in the World Series. It really was a dream come true. It just, you couldn't keep the Cubs off the bases. Maybe for a time, but when it came down to it, they were just beautiful hitters. And situational hitting, good base running. You didn't see too many guys get picked off and make dumb plays like they used to in the past, where they get picked off or they're running from third to home on a grounder to short. We don't do that stuff anymore. There's a system in place. And, you know, it invigorates you to watch this on TV, because you want to watch the game until the very last out. And isn't that what Bud Selig wants? Doesn't he want that theater? Isn't that what they're all after? Just to watch that game. Anybody who was watching that last game in the World Series, wasn't it sensational? The rain delay, the Cubs are winning, the Cubs are losing, Indians tied, home run, and all your stellar pitchers are fizzling, and it's up to the little guys to come out. The little guys who no one thought would be of any consequence come out, and they do it. So that's what I love about this year. It gave me a lot of new inspiration, regardless if the Cubs did it or not. I like the Indians. I thought they were fantastically prepared against the Cubs. They gave the Cubs everything they could handle, and I give them all the credit in the world.
It was an amazing World Series, and looking ahead to what comes next, the Cubs have indicated that this is not going to be a status quo offseason, and that they are wisely going to seek to get better in 2017, now that they are the hunted rather than the hunters. But as far as how that goes, again, from the outside looking in, you think if you're projecting the next couple of years here and whether or not this team has a chance to be a dynasty, notwithstanding the fact that they had impeccable starting pitching this year, Hendricks aside, you start looking down the road and you start seeing how quickly these guys are going to start to age. So is that going to be a focus going forward here, as far as putting more resources into that, maybe trading a surplus bat for an arm, maybe trying to do something like that? Because you would think, again, if you're another one of the teams in let's stick with the National League for a second, because they're the ones that have to first and foremost concern themselves with the Cubs. One would think that that's the way. If you want to build a team to get past the Cubs, maybe you try and emphasize starting pitching a little bit here. Are they going to try and get ahead of the curve on that?
I think the Cubs are going to be looking at Lackey pretty intensely to see what they're going to do with him. They're going to keep him in a starting rotation. He wasn't featured at all, really, in the World Series. I don't know if he had an arm problem. They look at Arrieta. Is that the Arrieta of 2015? Is 2016 going to be less effective in 2017. You give him the big money. I mean, he's a great pitcher. But, you know, when you're looking at the Cubs, he's going to demand a lot of dough. And do you give that money? Is it better to let him test the free agent market and see what the other teams? Sometimes you have to set marketability standards. And as much as you hate to let the guy go to free agency, you don't want to overpay. You want to pay what the market will bear. The Cubs are going to find it out with Dexter Fowler that, you know, he's going to test the free agent waters. And you can't blame him. He had a great year. He was a very good player. And, you know, the Cubs have the resources to pay anybody they want. But I don't think they're going to go crazy and overpaying like you saw with Soriano and some of the other players that Jim Hendry had. I think they're a little bit more scientific in their pursuits of who they're going to pay the big dollars to. And so that in itself is almost like a drama that's going to unfold this offseason. Our team's going to come forth and make fabulous offers for Arrieta. Are they going to do that kind of thing? Will a Cub listen? Will a Cub sign Chapman after dealing four players away for him? You know, you just can't let a guy walk after dealing four players, especially when he throws 105 miles an hour. There's not too many guys out there like that, especially left-handers. So I think Chapman's going to come back. The Cubs will have to, you know, either pay him or not pay him, but I think he'll be a Cub because there's nobody out there that's better than him. So these are all the fun little follies that, you know, the GMs and the you know, team presidents have to work through because you can't stand pat. You know, time will pass you by if you don't improve. And there's
absolutely
a calculated risk when you're a player. So who knows? I love watching the, you know, the dramas unfold, but there's been no hot talks, you know, hot stove league talks here in Chicago about anything. It's been very, very quiet on that front. And I'm always very interested to find out what they're going to do. I mean, the White Sox are kind of incidental. They're now in the shadows of the Cubs, and they're not shaking the trees. They're not. You don't even know they're alive. There's not even a leaf wriggling over there. There's nothing going on this outside. And that's too bad because they should be ashamed. They should be inspired to do better and become more Cub-like. There's enough money in Chicago to go for two teams. There's 8 million people. And I think that they could do a better job. But we'll see what happens with the Cubs. It's going to be very interesting. You know, a lot of people have put their opinions in there, who's going to stay, who's going to go. But it's going to be very nice to see who shows up to spring training in 2017 on the Cubs.
Well, the last thing I want to ask you, Jerry, in terms of the White Sox, let's bring it around to them again. I mean, the blueprint's right in front of them, isn't it? They're the White Sox for years have had a farm system that is hot garbage, essentially, if we're going to be perfectly honest. The Cubs built this thing with an impeccable farm system, and now these guys are coming up, and yeah, you're going to have to pay them eventually, but that's the way you want to do it. If the White Sox would just prioritize what they should already be prioritizing, because Reinsdorf wants to run this thing on a tight budget, okay, that doesn't work unless you have a good farm system. Essentially, aren't the Cubs just sort of showing them the path to do what they should have been doing for the last 15 years anyways?
Well, there's a blueprint. You know, Kansas City is a good blueprint to go young, and they kind of were the catalyst of overhauling a bad organization, and the Cubs did the same thing. They knew they had to extract everything and dump it out, and it was a pile of refuse. But the White Sox, under Mr. Reinsdorf, and I'll say it because I'm in Chicago, do I call them a fuddy-duddy? I guess I do because, you know, the Bulls go cheap and they get, you know, cheap GMs and they get cheap coaches and they founder and they're nothing but a mediocre team. They draw well, but they're just very mediocre. The White Sox, same thing.
Right.
Cheap managers, cheap GMs, they've never done anything. They've never really achieved anything outside, you know, Bob Ventura was a nice player, but you see what you get in the dugout? He's never done it. He's no Terry Francona. He's no Joe Maddon. He's no Don Mattingly. You know, but Don came in and he had a struggle, but he's a pretty good manager. You can almost tell who's good and who's not. And the White Sox just, and the Bulls, they just go down that path of least resistance and the product shows, the attendance shows, the media cover shows, the popularity shows, and too bad, you know, I like them both, but I'll just say how it is. I mean, I've covered them, and I can say it. I think the Blackhawks and the Cubs have the working ingredients. Scotty Bowman's got a good system. They got a good coach in Quenville. And the Cubs are the same thing. And you know what? When I worked at the Cubs, I worked in PR. John McDonough was the marketing guy. So John and I go way back. And you know what? He walked into the Blackhawks office, did the same thing he did with the Cubs, and he's an ideal marketer. There's nobody better. And he just happened to cross paths with Scotty Bowman's kid. And what a marriage this was. And, you know, they're living proof that systems can win. You know, the Blackhawks have lost a lot of great, you know, hockey players. But, you know, now this year they're hot again. It seems like every other year they're right in the Stanley Cup, you know, hunt. And I think that Theo and Jed got the makings of one of the greatest duos in sports history. I think they have every chance of repeating next year. But, again, there's a lot of good fortune that goes along with, you know, preparation and making sure these guys, you know, Madden plays them all, gives everybody a day off here or there. We don't care about Ironman anymore. Give them a couple of days off and let them come back in. And it's inspiring to see these guys that you never heard before come in and have two or three or four great games. They came in and did it. And I love that. I think that's just good baseball. It's the way baseball should be. It's a team effort, not just, you know, the same nine guys day in, day out. It's a team effort. It's all 24, 25 guys. And, I mean, who couldn't cheer on Schwarber when he came in and started hitting like he did in Cleveland? That was really fun to watch. Even if you weren't a Schwarber fan, you just got to be happy for the guy.
Well, one of the things that, again, makes the Cubs most dangerous in the time ahead here is that certainly at this point, they can afford a very good payroll, but unlike some of the paper Lions of the last couple of years, the Yankees, the Dodgers, it doesn't matter if your payroll's real bloated if it's inefficient. And with the Cubs, it is not going to be inefficient. They're going to be getting bang for their buck, and there's going to be a lot of bucks in there, and that is the most lethal combination that you could ask for. But certainly, as we go along with the Cubs being one of the predominant stories in baseball, I'm sure over the next several years, I'll have to stay on top of this with you. Jerry, a pleasure as always, sir, talking this over with you. Thank you so much for your insight today.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great Christmas.
Thank you. You too. Merry Christmas, Jerry. Take care. Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody, for joining us today for mini episode number 787 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.